Hi, everybody. Today is Monday, May 26th, 2025, and our friend Professor Jeffrey Sachs is back with us. Welcome back, Professor.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Professor, Donald Trump and the case of Iran, the nuclear program of Iran, it seems that yesterday he said he's optimistic about what's going on between the United States and Iran after the fifth round of negotiations. And we know that before the negotiation, the last round of negotiation, Steve Witkoff said no enrichment, Iranian part rejected that. But it seems that the situation is somehow optimistic. What's going on, in your opinion, right now?
I'm not in the room, so I can't give you an authoritative account. But the Iranian position has been quite clear. The Iranian position has been that Iran will open itself to all relevant inspections. It will definitively end its nuclear program. How much of a nuclear program there's actually been is a question mark. But in any event, Iran has said, yes, we want to end the program to develop nuclear weapons, but in return for a normalization of relations with the United States and an end of sanctions. Essentially, what was on the table with the JCPOA back in 2016 and 2017, which Trump turned down. Of course, Iran has been very, very clear that certain things are off the table. Iran reserves the right to enrich uranium for a civilian nuclear power program. And it has said all along from the start that that is the basis for an agreement, that Iran is not going to eliminate its enrichment capacity. We know that it's possible to do a modest amount of enrichment up to a certain limit that is safe, monitorable, and completely consistent with a complete closure of a nuclear arms development program. So I think Iran's position is perfectly reasonable, perfectly clear. The U.S. does not want a war with Iran, even though Netanyahu certainly wants the U.S. to have a war with Iran. It's quite clear that Trump does not want a war with Iran, and good for him. He's on the right side of this issue. So I think the expressions of optimism are on the basis that an agreement, a rational, reasonable agreement, can be reached. What Iran is asking is perfectly sensible. What the United States wants is achievable, an end of the threat of a nuclear breakout, of the development of nuclear weapons. And so the basis for an agreement is certainly there. And I'm hoping that that's why they express optimism after each round.
The positive face of the Trump administration, to my understanding, is Steve Witkoff. He's somehow the new sort of fresh air to the foreign policy of the United States. But at the same time, we see that the establishment, if we assume that we have some sort of division within the Trump administration, they're forcing Witkoff. They're putting a lot of pressure on him. What do they want from Witkoff with the negotiations with Iran?
Well, the United States has a deep state. That means that it has a standing security machinery that is a big business, well over $1 trillion a year, very powerful, organized at the Pentagon, the CIA, the Armed Services Committees of the U.S. Congress, think tanks all up and down the East Coast of the United States funded by all of this, and the Israel lobby, which is, of course, ardently anti-Iran. And the Israel lobby absolutely coincides with the deep state and the military-industrial complex of the United States. So there are powerful political forces that have been in play for 46 years, actually, at least since 1979. Against Iran, and they don't just go away because Trump wants to avoid a war. We see the same in Ukraine. Trump wants to end the U.S. engagement in Ukraine. But I'd say most of the people around him continue the deep state policy that the U.S. should invest in more war. After all, it's the Ukrainians dying, not the Americans dying. And so this phenomenon of a divided Washington, because the president, in this case, actually on the more peaceful side, and the deep state is pretty much a militarized and warmongering set of institutions, because war is their business and it's big business. This is not shocking. The question is, what will happen? Who will prevail? There's a famous line of Vladimir Putin in an interview in 2017 to Le Figaro, where he said, and it's become quite famous, he says, you know, he's worked with many American presidents. He said they come into office with some ideas, and then men with the briefcases and dark suits and blue ties come to visit them and explain realities to the U.S. president. As Putin says, and those ideas are never heard of again. And what he means is that presidents get talked out of their peace initiatives. And Trump absolutely could get talked out of this. You've got a wall of opposition to making peace with Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine. There's so much warmongering in all of the European capitals, virtually, certainly in London, in Paris, in Berlin, in Warsaw, to continue the war. And you see it in the United States, even on Trump's own team. Kellogg definitely is basically on the European wavelength on this. He doesn't want peace with Russia. At most, he wants kind of freezing the conflict, but NATO enlargement and so on. So Trump has to grapple with a war machine which defines the U.S. government. And we've had, you know, other presidents. The last one that really tried to make peace a center of the administration was actually John F. Kennedy. And many people, including myself, think he was killed because of those actions, because the deep state, in that case, probably elements of the CIA, said, we're not going through with this.
We know that Marco Rubio is talking about snapback sanctions, which were considered in JCPOA during the Obama administration. When you look at this current situation of Iran today, and where they're talking about snapback sanctions, they're considering Europe together with Russia and China. Where are we with the situation of snapback sanctions? How much pressure they can put on Iran?
Again, I'm not in these negotiations. There is absolutely a wall of anti-Iranian sentiment in Washington. And one of the issues that Iran faces is that even if it reaches an agreement, the U.S. can change its mind or change its policies or use a pretext to reimpose sanctions or walk away from an agreement. After all, the JCPOA was laboriously negotiated in 2015 and 2016 by real nuclear experts who came up with a good agreement. And then Trump and the Senate just absolutely ripped it to shreds. So on what kind of sanctions and whether Iran will agree to something that is very flimsy and can get them into, again, another trap. I'm not in the room, but if I were Iran, I'd worry about it.
Yeah. Donald Trump's recent visit to Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Qatar, and they were so generous to Donald Trump. What do they want from Donald Trump? They consider the United States as their friend. But when it comes to the Middle East, what's the main concern on their part?
They all host U.S. Military bases. They all want to stay in power. They all think that the United States can provide them with the wherewithal to stay in power, and they all worry about being on the wrong side of the United States, given the very strong military presence of the United States in these countries. I think that that's the main motivation. Frankly, I don't think they get a lot out of this relationship, not the way that they think. The Middle East is unstable, basically because of U.S. foreign policy. Defending an absolutely rogue state, Israel, rather than defending international law and creating the state of Palestine. And the burden of that U.S. Defense of Israel hurts everybody in the Gulf region. So I don't think that they're getting what they think they're getting out of this relationship. I think I wish, and I think the Arab world should be more clear to the U.S. We want peace in the Middle East. Peace requires two-state solution. You got to get on with it, because otherwise this doesn't work. It's perpetual war. That's bad for business, bad for our security, bad for our stability. And that's the truth that I hope someone's explaining to Trump. I'm not sure. There was a lot of glad handing and a lot of announcements of trillions of dollars that are going to be invested in the United States. But what did the counterparts get out of that? Not clear.
The dangerous part of what's going on in the Middle East is an Israeli attack on Iran. They're talking about if they stop negotiating with the United States, we're going to attack them. If they progress in the negotiations, we're going to attack them. Is there any sort of limit on the part of the Trump administration for Netanyahu? For Netanyahu's Israel, for his administration, for Netanyahu and his administration when it comes to Iran?
This is the trillion-dollar question. The United States has run U.S. Middle East policy for decades. Whatever Israel has done, the U.S. has backed. And during this whole disastrous period of recent years, when Israel is destroying Gaza and killing tens of thousands of people, there basically hasn't been a peep from the United States to stop all of this. The question of whether the United States is ever going to stand up to an absolutely extremist Israeli government is a big question. The Israel lobby is extremely powerful in the United States. By the way, in terms of votes, far and away, the power of the Israel lobby is evangelical Christians. It's not a Jewish lobby. Very heavily by the numbers, an evangelical Christian lobby. But it's a big part of Trump's base. And whether Trump can be president and do what's right for the United States, or whether he'll follow this part of his base, which is very extreme, a decided minority of voters, but a significant part of Trump's own voters, remains to be seen. Of course, it's been a disaster for decades. The United States has basically done what Netanyahu has said, and it's not surprising, but it is terrible. We have war in Gaza. We have war in the West Bank. We have war in Lebanon. We have war in Syria. We have the threat of war in Iran. We have war in Libya. We have war in Sudan. And Israel's played a very bad role fomenting or encouraging many of those conflicts, if not all of them, in some sense.
Can we say that the most important countries when it comes to their influence in the Middle East are Iran and the United States, because I don't see Russia and China are somehow involved in that rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. But overall, when you look at the Middle East, the United States and Iran are so bold. Is that the case in your mind?
I think it's more complicated. There are many actors that are significant in the Middle East. That's one of the reasons why it's so complicated. But don't leave out Turkey and its role. Don't leave out Saudi Arabia. Don't leave out Egypt with its 120 million people, its fragility in some ways, its historical role in the region, its still significant role as home to Al-Azhar and other leading institutions. So for me, the Middle East is a confluence of grand civilizations that go back thousands of years. They're all still present. The Persians, the Turks, the Christians, the Jews, the Muslims across the region, and the Arabs. I mean, it's complicated. So it is not just the United States and Iran, and great powers have been meddling in this region. Also, I think it's right to say 3,000 years. So you've had endless wars, because this region is so important to the world as a center of civilization, a crossroads of civilizations, a crossroads for physical trade routes, and all of that remains true today.
Can you compare China's behavior and attitude in the Middle East to the United States one? Because there's so much different attitudes there. And is the United States going to learn from China if they're much successful? They're much more successful than the United States.
Well, statecraft in China and statecraft in the North Atlantic world, meaning whether it's the UK or the US or Western Europe, are completely different historically, and I think completely different in self-perception and in future behavior. You know, in international relations theory, as taught in the United States, it said, oh, states behave the same way no matter who they are. I think that this is absolutely not the case. China has never had overseas empires. China never meddled in the Middle East. The Middle East was dominated by Britain and, to a lesser extent, France for a very long time. After World War II, the United States carried the baton that Britain had before World War II as really the undoubted regional hegemon in the Middle East. Britain and the U.S., of course, overthrew Mossadegh in 1953. The Iranian elected prime minister, creating tumult that would follow for basically 70 years onward. So the U.S. is an imperial power. It learned its methods of imperial rule from Britain. The U.S. is an Anglo-Saxon country by origin and elite culture, and it behaves like an empire. It behaves like an imperial power in the Middle East, a colonizing power, and the leading war power of the Middle East. China's completely different. China is only present commercially. It's only present as a calm, stabilizing voice. It's only present as one of the permanent members of the UN Security Council. China has a big interest in Middle East stability because of energy and other geopolitical conditions, but China's just has nothing to do with being an imperial power. It never was for an overseas, in an overseas sense, and I don't think it's going to be.
Yeah. We had the conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, on Sky News. She said something so much amazing. First time I've heard that. That was surprising. She said that Israel is fighting a proxy war on the part of the United Kingdom. How can you make sense of that?
Wow. I missed the statement. A proxy war vis-a-vis whom, was she saying?
It's about, I don't know, the region, Palestinians.
Look, I can tell you, I have a theorem that almost all world problems go back to the British. So the British have made a mess in so many parts of the world. The list is extremely long. It's also true that while Britain lost its empire basically 80 years ago, it still fantasizes that it is a great imperial power. And when you hear a statement like you just said, which I haven't heard, so I can't fully interpret it, but it's a kind of absurdity.
Let me, Professor, play it for you. I think that would be helpful if you heard that.
Prime Minister Joyce, do you think that Mr. Netanyahu's language on this is justified?
I'm not here to police the language of the Prime Minister.
I'm not asking
Israel.
You to police it. I'm
so
asking
what he has said. People
need to know where you stand.
Yeah, but
on
I've
this.
Been very clear where I stand. Hamas is a terrorist group. They are not our friends.
I'm talking about what you think about the Israelis.
Yes, but it's all related. Who funds Hamas? Iran, an enemy of this country. Israel is fighting a proxy war on behalf of the UK, just like Ukraine is on behalf of the West of Western Europe against Russia. We have to get serious. We have to get serious. There was a terrorist plot in London against the Israeli embassy. We saw two Jewish members of the Israeli embassy in DC killed. Whose side are we on? We need to make sure that the hostages are returned. No one wants to see a war in Gaza. Palestinians are suffering. And Netanyahu is complaining that he thinks our leaders are carrying out the wrong action. He has every right to say that. What I want to see is Keir Starmer making sure that he is on the right side of British national interest. That cannot be on the side.
Yeah, British national interest.
Oh, my God. Something's happened to Britain. It is so pathetic. One of these characters after the next. It's absolutely shocking. Now, if you put Starmer there, he'd be the same fool. If you put Boris Johnson there before, the same idiocy. One after another. I don't know where to start, but Britain is in such a tailspin. Of course, who am I to talk? We have Donald Trump. The collapse of political leadership in the North Atlantic is kind of like a coda to the overall end of Western hegemony. Not only is there the end of Western dominance in the world, but you kind of put the icing on the cake by having this political idiocy that we were just watching on this film. Absolutely unaccountable, vulgar, but par for the course. Starmer's no better. It's just awful. The degradation of British politics.
The tragedy is that they're playing the same role in Ukraine. They're doing
exactly the same role. All they know is war and these stupid comments and this vainglory of empire. And telling people what to do, idiocy. Starmer is just such a fool. But by the way, so was Boris Johnson. And Johnson played exactly the same role. So this is interesting because this is deep state phenomena. This transcends parties. We have basically the same thing in the United States, though want to say Trump is trying, maybe not successfully, maybe fitfully, maybe episodically, but he's trying, I think, to end the war in Ukraine. Starmer's not even remotely trying to end the war in Ukraine.
And yesterday, Donald Trump said that Vladimir Putin is so crazy. He's killing a lot of people, not just soldiers. They're killing. He was talking about civilians. What is the main goal of this mainstream policy? Because there, when you go out, and he talked recently with Vladimir Putin, it was a phone call, more than 2 hours. They were talking about many things, not just Ukraine. But who's forcing Donald Trump in the position that he's taking right now, which it seems that he's somehow feeling that he needs to leave the scene, to let it in the hands of Ukrainians and Russians to make some sort of solution, to make some sort of settlement.
No, but he said something even more than that now when he said Putin's absolutely crazy. He said maybe we have to put on sanctions again. So it's not extricating the U.S., it's reverting to the mainstream deep state, which is possible because he's surrounded by Marco Rubio and Waltz and Kellogg and Lindsey Graham. And we didn't have 30 years of warmongering for nothing, and it didn't just go away on January 20th, 2025. We have a military-industrial complex that is the basis of the American empire, and that still is there. And Trump's trying to end a war, but no one likes to end war among these imperial powers. Even a country like Britain, which lost its empire 80 years ago, doesn't like to end war. France loves the warmongering right now. The United States is the only country where the leader, it seems once in a while, to be trying to wind down the war. But then a statement like today could mean just a reversion to back to where we were before. Putin didn't do anything, quote, absolutely crazy. The Iranians launched massive drone attacks, including on Moscow in recent days. The Western European governments are so incredible in not saying one word about how to actually reach peace. They talk about a ceasefire, but not how to actually reach peace. That to call Putin crazy and not call Zelensky, Starmer, Macron, Tusk, Mertz as warmongering, you know, it's just strange. And it's very disturbing because basically it may be that Trump doesn't have the stamina to persevere. Maybe doesn't understand, maybe doesn't have the personal stamina. Maybe he's so much under the assault of the deep state. But the lines today were definitely not helpful to peace and definitely not helpful to Ukraine.
If you were to mention the main difficulty on the part of the Trump administration, would be the technical parts of what's going on in Ukraine, or somehow the bigger picture, the strategy of the United States in dealing with Russia and the way that they're getting some sort of pressure from the deep state?
It's the latter. Look, basically, the U.S. gambled that it could pull Ukraine into the Western orbit and do it with NATO enlargement and make Russia fold. And that was the bet. And that bet was wrong. For Russia, this was such a core set of issues that when the United States helped to overthrow a pro-Russian government or Russia-friendly government in Ukraine next door, when the United States built up the largest army in Europe, actually, in Ukraine during a Trump 1 period, when the United States refused to negotiate over the NATO question at all. This is the deep state at work. And Trump came in with the right idea that this isn't in America's interest and it's not working. Most importantly, from Trump's point of view, is this failed. This was a gambit. This was, remember, Americans play poker. This was, trying to bet the pot with a pair of twos. They vastly overplayed their hand. They bluffed, or they believed their own press releases, but they thought that that Putin would fold, if you keep the poker analogy, and he didn't fold. So Trump came in and said, I don't want to play this hand anymore. This is Biden's hand. That all makes sense. But as soon as he said it, the entire political class of the United States and Western Europe jumped up and down. Oh, that's appeasement. You can't do that. You're just doing Trump's, Putin's line and Putin's interest. What do they think? What's the plan that Starmer has? How many Ukrainians is he going to kill, according to his plan? Is it another 500,000? What is the plan? Is Starmer really going to defeat Russia, Britain, which can't even keep its clinics open anymore? It's really going to defeat Russia right now? So they don't have a plan. They're just warmongering, and as long as it's the Ukrainians dying, that's fine. And they portray themselves as friends of Ukraine. Part of the problem is Zelensky. He's a dictator. He can't let go either. But he's killing his own people, plain and simple. For what? For what prospect? What are the costs, the benefits, and the likelihoods? People don't want to talk about any of that. But the vast likelihood is that all this is a path to continued war that destroys Ukraine in the end. That's the path we're on. And Trump has been trying to get off that path, but whether he's really staying off the path or not remains to be seen. And his posting today about Putin gone absolutely crazy, this is a very bad sign. It shows that he's succumbing to all the normal politics of Washington.
Can we understand why did Russia decide to talk directly with Ukrainians? Because before they said they're not going to talk with Zelensky and his administration because Zelensky is not officially the president of Ukraine. Is that related to what Donald Trump wasn't able to get from Ukraine or somehow was manipulated by the Europeans? Go ahead, Professor.
No, I think Russia has said all along for years, they want to end this at the negotiating table, but they want the negotiations to be about ending the underlying causes of the war. It makes perfect sense, by the way. You want to end this war. It's not by freezing the conflict so that the war can start again. It's by going to the root causes, NATO enlargement, collective security, territorial issues, and so on. So Russia has not resisted negotiating. It's laid out its position. It's probably negotiable in some parts, but to find out, you have to negotiate. Europe doesn't want to negotiate. Europe doesn't lay out any position. Zelensky's position is total victory, total capitulation of Russia, war crimes, trials, reparations. It's kind of a delusional list that is the opposite of really trying to get an end to the conflict. So I think it's not surprising that Putin said, let's negotiate. By the way, just as a footnote, they didn't say who they would sign with. They said they would negotiate terms. And they're going to exchange some papers on this. So Russia will be stating, here are the terms and why of ending this conflict. Ukraine apparently won't do that. The Western world won't do that. They don't talk about how to actually end the war, because that would force them to get into issues like, should NATO really expand? To this day, the Europeans are saying yes. This is nuts, by the way. This is just the recipe to completely destroy Ukraine, to carry on with such imbecilities. Sorry. NATO should never have tried to expand to Ukraine. It was reckless. It was warmongering. It was known by experienced people that it could lead to deadly conflict. It never should have been done. But my God, given what's happened since 2022, for Europeans to continue to say, absolutely, Ukraine will join NATO, is shocking to me. We're going to have to finish up shortly.
Thank you so much, Professor Sachs. Great pleasure, as always.
Well, great to be with you. And we'll continue lots to talk about. And these issues are unfortunately not going away anytime soon.
Yeah. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.